You are listening to Punk News Podcast 224, 2 days before Thanksgiving, 3 days before Record Store Day, Black Friday, and 1 day for me before the Dwarves, but you're not going to be there because you don't live in Philadelphia unless you do, in which case I'll see you at the Dwarves anyway. This is Punk News Podcast number 224. To the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile, and I'm here with two guys. Well, one guy is always here, as he should be, because he is, I want to say, a diamond in the rough, but he's just a diamond. He has insightful insight. He has clear diction, and he has, I want to say, elevated thought. He's very reasonable, a very thoughtful, a very sophisticated, philosophical, but also down-to-earth kind of fellow. You say, who's that? But of course, everybody knows that's Managing Editor Adam White. Managing Editor Adam White, how are you doing? Are you ready to take out your Aristotle-like knowledge and insight once again on this week's Punk Rock Happenings?
I don't know why you would say those things, but that's nice. I guess, if that's what the people want, you know.
Well, you are growing a beard out, I believe, much in the style of the ancient Greek scholars.
Yeah, which makes me smarter, if anything.
I think this was a Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld skit about how smoking a cigarette makes you look nervous, but smoking a cigar makes you look learned. Why does a beard make you look learned? A person, not you. I mean, why does a beard make a person look learned?
I would have to imagine that for certain people it would age them in, like, a good way. So, like me, without any facial hair, you sort of look like a weird little boy, then it's the kind of thing that might help you achieve, you know, actual adulthood. I'm not quite sure. There are certain people that look fucking crazy with a beard, mind you.
Charles Manson, for one.
Yes, without a beard, Charles Manson could be your banker, right?
We'll have the swastika on his forehead, too.
Well, no, with, right? I don't want to judge.
Well, there you go. And also, speaking of a guy that in a couple of years he'll be able to grow his very own beard, which we're all excited
about.
God. We are here with news writer and now interviewer, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, Thanksgiving is coming up. I think your 14th birthday is coming up. What are you doing for Thanksgiving? Do you think Grandma will let you sip the wine?
Oh, can only hope this time. But yeah, I'm excited to almost be able to get my learner's permit to drive. So just Ricky, one more year, John. Just one more year.
What are you doing for Thanksgiving? Is it going to be a big family hoedown?
Yes, actually. Got cousins coming in and my brother and sister coming in. And the three of us will probably just get really hammered and, you know, kind of see what happens.
What's like getting hammered with a sibling? I've never gotten hammered with any relative ever, actually.
It's a lot of fun, especially because we don't need to really go anywhere and try and find other people unless they come to our place. But it's a bonding experience.
Adam White, have you ever gotten hammered with a sibling or a relative?
Hammered's probably not the right word.
Tipsy?
My brother and I, as we've gotten older, have realized that we are good. We are good drinking partners, so we will try to partake sometimes. But I don't think anyone gets hammered. It's not like high school where you're like, you know, we're gonna go hide in the woods and drink Old English or something. Like no, it's a little bit more. I'm gonna say it's a little bit more refined than that.
You know, I wanted to make today's podcast fairly shorter because it's time for a compact one, but let's just, Adam, when's the first time you ever drank briefly and what was that experience like?
Oh my God. It actually involves Old English. This is what's great about it. So I want to say I was, I don't know, like 15, maybe something like that. And we had this, we had a casual acquaintance, let's call him. I don't want to call him a friend, really, because I don't know whatever happened to him, and he might be a serial killer now. But he was a casual acquaintance of ours, so we went over to his place, which was his family had kind of like a farmish kind of area that was a little bit out of town. And we went for, I don't know, we were like still young. So we went for like, you know, we're going to stay over at his house that night. And we sat around on a trampoline outside and drank like 40s of Old English as the first thing that I'd ever drank. It was, I think, the first and only time I've ever drank malt liquor. And it was not something I intend to drink anymore, but that was it. And then like woke up in the morning and kind of had to like wander home down like the dusty country road back to civilization.
Tricky Ricky, when's the first time you ever drank?
God, this is, well, so I was also 15, and let's see, it was when a bunch of fights broke out after an assembly in high school, and so what they did was they shut down the school, and they only, and for 2 hours I was stuck in the class where the teacher just had it out for me. Everyone knew he had it out for me. So I was stuck.
Why'd he have it out for you?
I wouldn't drop his class. He kept trying to make me drop it.
Why would he just try to make you drop a class?
He was one of those. I'm sure you've seen The Paper Chase because you're. I mean, have you seen that movie?
No.
Oh, it's about like this really kind of like totalitarian like teacher who like uses the Socratic method and stuff like that, and you know, calling people out. And at the time, I was having issues in the class and couldn't, and I wasn't able to answer like one or two questions that week, and he just really wanted to just break my soul.
You weren't doing well in the class.
Yeah, but I wasn't failing. I was just not doing, you know, like a work. That was the thing.
I'm gonna give some advice that I wish someone had given me when I was younger in high school, but especially in college. But high school too. If you're really lost in a class and everyone's been there, everyone's been in that one or two class where everybody there is smarter than you. You have no idea what's like. You're so behind or you're so confused. You don't even know what questions to ask, especially in college, but high school too. Contact a professor outside of class and say, "Can you like explain something? Like explain this to me?" And go in and talk to the professor and see if you can get some help. And I'll tell you what. I had this happen to me once. It was macroeconomics, advanced macroeconomics or whatever, or honors macro, I had no idea what was going on. Everybody's way smarter than me. I literally had no idea what was going on. And the guy explained stuff to me. I still didn't get it, but let me tell you, the situation explained to me was the final exam. So often, teachers are happy to help you out, and even if you don't get it, a lot of times they'll literally give you test answers just because they realize you're trying to get ahead. Not always. Sometimes teachers are just dicks, but I mean, sometimes they help you out.
Oh, this guy was a total dick. But anyway, I mean, it got him picking on me got so bad that one day a girl like who I did never really talk to actually called me to see if I was okay. I was fine.
Man, Rick, you had the girls calling you all the time.
That was complete pity. That wasn't even like that. That was just a new low for high school for me. But
when life gives you lemons,
what? Oh yeah. Well, so they closed, they shut down.
Welcome to the Punk News Podcast.
Well, they shut down the school, and I was stuck in this guy's class for like 2.5 hours. And I went back to my, they finally let us out like an hour after school was supposed to end. I was all stressed out and pissed off. And my neighbor who was, he was a year younger than me. He's like, let's just raid our liquor cabinet so we can all relax. And it turns out I completely overdid it. And then we just started walking around the boulevard. Next thing I knew, I see my grandmother's car in our driveway. I'm like, shit, I completely forgot that she came over for dinner. So I just, and this is my first time with alcohol. So I'm walking around like barely able to walk in a straight line. She asked me to like bring some like, you know, pot, like ceramic pots and bowls into the house. I'm like, God damn it, this is not what I need right now. And I could barely eat dinner because I was on the verge of vomiting the whole time, but I didn't. Happily ever after, and here I am.
Oh my God, that was great for like four or five reasons. One, it was because you were really pissed off.
I was just pissed off. I was just pissed off and just stressed out that I was stuck in that guy's class for
like a beat cop, like 2 months from retirement, and like the grind is just too much for you, and you just have to like sit in your office and just like drink whiskey.
I love the Ferris Bueller angle or whatever. It's like he's drunk and he's walking over, like, oh crap, grandma came over, and then grandma comes out, Ricky, can you carry in this fragile plate?
It was awful, but no, I was just like, I was just pissed off and stressed out. It just happened to be that day when the school got shut down. It was so stupid, but definitely memorable. So that was fun.
Let's get this podcast started. Let's talk about drinking grandmas more and how to do better in college. So anyways, Record Store Black Friday is in 3-4 days from now. Apparently they don't do it in Canada, but they do it in America. Record Store Black Friday is like a mini Record Store Day. It's basically Record Store Day, but they have fewer releases. You know, I've always been an ardent proponent of Record Store Day in the past. I might be changing my view now. Adam or Ricky, are any of you guys doing Record Store Day Black Friday this year? Are there any hot releases coming out on Record Store Day Black Friday?
I was looking at Amoeba Records website. There isn't a whole lot. I usually save my Record Store Day, you know, enthusiasm when it comes in April. So, I mean, I'll stop by and get that Fugazi release that Amoeba's been throwing out there and that we've been talking about lately. But maybe I'm not like dying to go like I usually am in April.
So yeah, we don't have Black Friday up here per se, because we're not monsters like you guys. However, we're nothing if not wannabe monsters. So all the retailers up here have decided that it's kind of like it's Black Friday weekend month, whatever, anyways. But it doesn't mean anything because there's no everything costs more in Canada. So there's, you know, anyone that is serious about like shopping or anything like that's probably going to go to the States to buy shit anyways. And I've never heard of any store in Canada being, you know, inundated by mobs of, I don't know what you would call them, idiots trying to get the latest piece of shit that's on sale for whatever. So I don't know. Like we see that on we see it on the news, and it's always just like, you know, some place in Shitburg, Missouri had, you know, 25 people were killed in a Walmart because there was a doll on sale. Like that doesn't seem to happen up here, and it would because we're just as stupid, but I don't think we have like the prices that you do. So that doesn't seem to happen up here. So anyways, yeah, so that's my Canadian quasi high horse I got on there. I don't know. I was looking through the list here. There were probably things that I would pick up if I was there and they were an okay price, but that's not a hearty endorsement. So there's nothing on here that jumped out at me that I really need.
Well, that's a good point. Is actually on Record Store Day, I'm sort of getting burned out on the mega inflated prices, you know, $12, $15 for a 7-inch. $19 for a 10-inch, $25, $30 for a 12-inch. There's nothing that really jumped out at me at all, really. I mean, there's a David Bowie single. I can pass on that. There's a Judas Priest EP. That's their bonus tracks from their last album. But I have them on CD. So do I really need to spend $25 for 5 Judas Priest songs that I already have on CD? I don't, really. The only thing that's kind of interesting, I think, is the Morrissey 12. It's Morrissey Picks the Ramones. And so it's all Ramones songs I already have. They're just sequenced and chosen by Morrissey. So that's kind of interesting, but that's going to be like $30. I'm not going to spend $30.
See, that's an interesting blog post. That's not an interesting thing I'd have to buy.
True. Maybe in case the listeners don't know, it's actually a clever idea and concept. I mean, it's a more clever blog post. But way back in like 1976, Morrissey wrote into NME talking about how much he hated the Ramones. And then, you know, years later when I was like, Morrissey, how could you hate the Ramones? You're such an idiot. And he actually retracted his stance saying now he loves the Ramones. And he was wrong when he said he hated them and that the New York Dolls – well, he still might think the New York Dolls are better, but he said he was wrong about the Ramones. So it's kind of like a sly wink at his history, if you will. But, yeah, I'm not spending $30 for that, you know. So, I mean – and with regards to Record Store Day, this is – I've always – people have always said record store day sucks, you know, and it hurts record stores. I've always asked record stores, is it good? And they all said yes. But this year, my local record store, Jupiter Records, I mentioned them so much, it sounds like I'm getting paid by them, but I'm really not. I just like the record store. They say they're not doing it this year. They're just having an actual record store day. They're not having any exclusives. They said because they get stuck with too much junk. So maybe, you know, the stuff is so expensive now. Maybe record store day isn't what it used to be or beneficial towards record stores. I'll have to ask more record stores to see what the deal is. But it definitely seems like this one is lower key compared to the past, even for Black Friday. But moving on. Actually, you know what? Right into your opinion of record store day and record store day Black Friday. Is it still a venue for neat releases, or is it bloated and too expensive? Podcast@punknews.org. But let's get this week started, finally. Patrick Stewart. You guys know him as Captain Picard. You love him as Captain Picard. You know him as Professor X. You love him as Professor X. He's going to star in a film. The film is going to be called Green Room. And in the Green Room, Patrick Stewart stars as an evil skinhead leader. And here's, according to the producers, the plot of the movie. It is young punks who, after stumbling upon a horrific act of violence, find themselves trapped in a secluded venue, fighting for their lives against a gang of skinheads intent on eliminating all witnesses. So I've got an opinion with the whole punks versus skinheads thing, but do you guys think this is going to be good? Is it going to be like a grindhouse film, or will it actually be an intelligent movie?
This, to me, seemed like it was going to be like a... like From Dusk Till Dawn kind of movie. I assume this isn't a major release, right?
I actually kind of think it is. I mean, Patrick Stewart's in it. Patrick Stewart does not come cheap. He's Professor X, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know how big a release or anything this is going to be. I like to think that Patrick Stewart has like enough, you know, classical acting inclinations and stuff like that, that he'll be in stuff if he thinks it's interesting, as well as stuff that's just, you know, big and mass market. What I thought was, it sounds like if this was treated in a, you know, in a super gonzo way, it could be really fun. What I thought was kind of funny, and I was waiting for it when I read the description of the article, was how many people we were going to have, you know, rending their clothes and being all upset over the fact that, like, the skinheads are the enemies in this setup. Only because, I don't know, I think that, like, any of us that are in the punk rock thing, we're well aware that, you know, not all skinheads are racists, and that, you know, there are racist skinheads and there are non-racist skinheads, and skinhead culture has lots to do with, you know, Jamaican ska and reggae culture in London and blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah, we all know that. And I didn't think that we would have to become upset about the negative portrayal of a skinhead at this point. Like, we could brush it off and go like, yeah, whatever, that's the media. Let's just have fun. I don't know. There's still people in the comments section that were just like, oh, here we go. Skinheads being cast as the enemies again. And I was like, really? This is a war we're going to fight right now?
Well, along those lines, this is one thing I never understood with the whole... Yet we all know that most skinheads are not racist. But my question is this is, why is the hairstyle so important? Like, why don't they say, well, if racist skinheads are going to be racist, we'll just be the green-haired guys, you know, or the short-haired guys or the ponytail guys. Like, why not just change your hairstyle and then you don't have that problem at all? And I guess the reply is like, well, we're not in the wrong. Why should we have to change? But is the hairstyle itself that important? I think the, quote, lifestyle is more important than the hairstyle, so why not just keep doing what skinheads do, but, you know, change the hairstyle so you're not associated with the racist guys anymore?
It's a tough thing because it's not an ethnicity, right? Like, it's, you know, it's not like, it's, you know, it, I don't even know what I'm trying to say. It's not an ethnicity, right? It's not like something that you can't change. I'm not saying necessarily that they should change, but... I can never get upset about negative skinhead portrayals in the same way that I could that if it was you know, a, I want to say that. Like just, everything I, everything I'm going to say sounds disparaging here, but like if it was like a real culture, like this, it's a subculture thing, right? Like there were all sorts of stupid movies in the 80s and stuff like that that had all kinds of like goofball villain punks and stuff like that in it, but I was never just like, oh man, that's not what a real punk rocker's like. Hey, no, who the fuck cares? But I don't know.
I just don't know why they cling to the actual haircut so much. Just change it. Like, for example, like, you know, Ross, well, Rastafari is a very bad example. Let me think. Well.
I mean, it's tough. You can't find something that involves, like, passion over a hairstyle or a head covering or something that doesn't have a religious connotation to it.
That's what I'm looking for. Yeah. You know what I mean? Well, here's a good example. Let's say a bunch of racist guys started wearing JNCO jeans. I would think that the Juggalos would just stop wearing JNCO jeans. You know what I mean? And they would wear, like, tight jeans. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I can also see them going like, ah, whatever, fuck you, we're the real Juggalos, right? And then keep doing what they're doing. but that's kind of what I would expect the Skins to do. Just be like, ah, whatever, fuck those racist guys. You know, we're the real ones, but not, I don't know, not feel the need to be on the defensive all the time. I mean, I guess I could see why you're on the defensive all the time, because if people keep thinking you're racist.
But then change your situation. It's so easy to change your situation. That's my point. Just grow hair.
Got a letter from someone. I don't even know what my point is on this. It's just...
Well, Patrick Stewart...
I'm bemused.
Patrick Stewart... Bemused, excellent. Patrick Stewart is a natural skinhead. And I gotta say, man, I saw Patrick Stewart as Hamlet. I'm a huge Star Trek The Next Generation fan. So I went and saw Patrick Stewart as Hamlet. And it was... I mean, I'm not a play connoisseur, but I thought he was phenomenal. I think Patrick Stewart, like, genuinely is a great actor. I hope he's not just taking, like, cheesy roles to be funny. Like, I would be disappointed if this was like a schlock film. I really want to see Patrick Stewart using his gift, not ironically using his gift. You see what I'm saying?
I don't have the impression this is going to be goofy. So, hey, I don't know. It could be fun. It seems like there's a lot of punky kind of movies coming out in the next 2 years.
Because punks means cash, man.
Yes.
Speaking of punks earning a lot of cash, Sean Bonnet of Andrew Jackson Jihad recently appeared on WXPN down in Philadelphia. It's one of Philadelphia's public radio stations. I think it's a college radio station. They play a lot of interesting stuff there, a lot of good music there. He played a Folkadelphia session. He covered Neil Young, Cheap Girls, and a whole bunch of other people. I know Ricky's a big fan of this band. Interesting, in the comments, a lot of the kids said they like the stripped-down version of the new Christmas Island songs as opposed to the studio recording full versions. Ricky, where do you stand? Do you like the stripped-down jams or the full band recordings?
Well, you know, it seems like when the band signed to Side One and put this album out, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff seems to have changed. I mean, they got a full band now. Like I've said before, which I think has made a difference, and they don't just have studio musicians come in when they record an album. But this album, compared to like say Knife Man or like Can't Maintain, was fairly polished, not in like a bad way, but you know, it kind of like you can definitely see the difference that there was a transition period between their last release and Christmas Island. So. So I thought it was cool that they did this, and they've done other acoustic versions of their newer songs. But I was always a fan of the, you know, angsty folk kind of thing that they've had going on. They've gone a little bit more, I guess, electric and kind of like not necessarily darker, but like kind of like a gloomy atmosphere kind of thing. But I like this. I just didn't know why he chose the Andrew Jackson Jihad songs he chose to play. I thought they've been really pushing Getting Naked and Playing with Guns. And
I love that song.
And I like it. I thought Cocopelli Face Tattoo is probably my favorite song on the album. Children of God. But yeah, I mean, they've been really pushing that. I mean, with this and the 7-inch that they did for Fest. But no, this is cool. I liked it.
I've yet to figure out if I like this record or not. I know I'm talking about the record, not these recordings in particular, but it's memorable. I definitely think the songs are well written, I guess. But I can't quite tell if this is the kind of thing that I spent a good period of my youth scoffing at.
Adam, I was exactly in your position. The first time I saw Sean, actually the only time I saw him, it was Jeff Rosenstock, Dog Party, and Hard Girls, I think, and Sean Burnett closed. And I was angry. Like he's up there, it's just him and his guitar singing like this weenie sound of music. And I'm like, I came to a punk rock show, not some bullshit whiner. You know, I literally left the show angry. Like, I was pissed off. Like, I'm like, I hate this, you know? And then so I was never a big Andrew Jackson Jihad fan before. But then, you know, the new record was very popular. I heard it, and at first I heard it, and I wanted to hate it. And the more I listened to it, I couldn't hate it. And here's why. Two reasons. First, it's less weeny than it used to be. Like, it's got a little bit more backbone. You know, I need some thunder in my music. You know, unless I'm listening to, you know, like, actually Linda Ronstadt or Carly Simon or something. But B, the lyrics, like, if you listen to the lyrics, I mean, the past year and a half, I've been on a real rudimentary peni kick. You know, some of the darkest, most evil / you know, horrifying lyrics you've ever heard. And I listen to these lyrics, and these my problem with this band is that it was too cutesy-wootsy for me. It was cute, it was clever, and I knew it was cute and it was clever, which made me hate it. The new record, I think, is not as much like that because, you know, there's lyrics about, you know, Jesus crying out to stop the crucifixion. There's gods who want to be killed because they hate their existence. There's songs about getting, like, being insane, starting a cult, getting naked, and blowing up atom bombs. Like, these really dark lyrics set to this whimsical backdrop, and I dig this record, man.
Yeah, I feel like I need to give it another shot. I think what I have is that we're approaching that kind of end of year list period, and there's something in the back of my head that's like, everyone likes that record. You haven't figured it out yet. You should really get on that. And
yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't rush it. I mean, if you pass it over, it's a contender for a spot on my list. But if you pass it over, I mean, like, this is not, well, I mean, it's a great record, but it's not like if you missed Classics of Love or Off's first record, something like that, you know?
I just want people to like me. That's all I want.
I honestly don't think this was their best release. I really liked it, but I don't think this is their best one.
This is the only release of theirs that I don't hate, and I really like this release.
Really, I gotta tell you, if you're going for lyrics, I think Knife Man's the way to go.
But there's no juice to it. It's all lyrics and no juice.
All right, well.
And speaking of a band that does have juice, this is exciting. And we had a pretty neat punk news exclusive. The band Really Red, which was an early Texas 80s hardcore band. They were pals with the Dicks and who's the other Big Boys? But I guess less known, perhaps, because they didn't talk about sexual politics, but they had more radical politics. Really Red is going to be releasing 3 volumes comprising all of the recorded material, plus a whole bunch of rarities and singles. It's going to be out on Alternative Tentacles on January 20th. The first two volumes are their first albums. The third volume is their singles and rarities. And Jello Biafra himself is remastering it himself. We were exclusively streaming 2 tracks, Teaching You the Fear and Too Political. And let me tell you, fellas, I dug these tunes. I am excited for this reissue. Moving on.
Adam, you want to go ahead?
Wow, sorry, I completely cut out there because I was trying to listen to something to see if it was relevant to what I was about to say. All right, I can't have 2 things happening at the same time as a professional. John, what do you want?
Oh, Really Red. Did you enjoy? Are you excited for this reissue, Adam?
I have no idea.
Well, if you know, fair enough. We've got 2 tracks streaming at punknews.org. Check them out. Ricky, did you dig Really Red? Are you excited? Are you not excited?
I had never heard of this band, but I did like that song Too Political. I thought it was funny. They were just like lashing out at everyone.
Yeah, I mean, they are a very vitriolic band. I mean, they're kind of a combination of like Dead Kennedys, but like nihilistic self-destruction, kind of like Electric Eels, kind of like the Pagans, that kind of stuff. So check it out. If you like hardcore, or if you like Gang of Four-style post-punk, or you like really radical music, or if you like all 3, check this out. I'm excited. Let's play a tune. I got a tune from this band called it's a very interesting track. I had never heard of this band before, but they emailed me. And they said, John, will you play us on the Punk News podcast? I said, I will. The band is called The Lame Brains, and they describe themselves as Youth Crew meets Angry Samoans. That's a very interesting mix. And so here's their song, and it is just called The Lame Brains Theme Song. And you can find them on Facebook at Lame Brains. Check it out. This rocking. The Bouncing Souls are kind of doing, I don't want to say it's a gimmick, but it's an interesting event for their annual Home for the Holiday shows. As you probably know, every year Bouncing Souls does between like 3 and 5 shows in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and they usually do special sets or do special things and have a lot of interesting opening bands. Well, this year, on both Friday, December 26th and Saturday, December 27th, they're inviting people to come play on stage with them, and here's how you get to do that. Before then, before December 17, you can email them at homefortheholidays2014contest@gmail.com, and you should record yourself singing or playing one of their songs, and they'll pick one guitarist, one vocalist, one bassist, and one drummer each to play songs with them on stage for like a song or two. Is this an interesting thing, or is this a gimmick, or is this just a lot of fun for the Christmas season?
I mean, I don't know what the actual atmosphere is like at one of their Home for the Holidays shows. I imagine it's fun, and that's why they would do something like this. Although it really makes me think that, like, there's been times where I've gone and I've seen a band and I've really wanted to see a certain song, and then for whatever reason, they pull a kid out of the crowd or get one of their roadies or something to come out and sing the song instead. Maybe because the band is just sick of it, which I could get for some of the bands that I'm referencing here. But it totally bummed me out because I'm like, oh, no, I didn't want to see some guy sing this song. So I'm wondering if that's going to be the case for some kids in the crowd there. Where, you know, they really want to hear, I don't know, what Bouncing Souls song do people really want to hear? They want to hear, like,
Julie's been working for the drug squad.
Yeah. So
Hard Times.
Why am I blanking on Bouncing Cold?
Band in DC.
It's a fucking hell. Okay, like Anthem? Kate is Great or something like that, right? So anyways, they're getting up there. They want to hear Hopeless Romantic, right? They want to hear that, you know, the song as it's kind of meant to be played, and instead they pull in like some guy from the crowd to sing the song, or the winner of the contest, or whatever it is. I don't know how much I would enjoy that. But, hey, I don't know. I imagine that they have a way to do this that'll be entertaining for people and not tedious.
Consider this. Is this a way to destroy the audience band construct and follow the famed punk philosophy as there being no division between the band and the audience?
I think that is putting way too much thought into it. But, but no, I mean, like... The Home for the Holiday shows are like, you know, it's the souls in Jersey with the people that, you know, are their hometown fans. These are the people that probably come out to each and every one of these shows each and every year. So I don't know if there's a whole lot of division between the band and the fan in this kind of situation. It doesn't necessarily mean I want to hear some kid play guitar, but I don't think there's that much.
I'd be into this if I won it, but other, like other than if I didn't, like I would, it seems like it's just, this is just kind of for fun. This isn't anything like, I don't think it's supposed to be taken too seriously. I would love to play like guitar with that band. That would be cool.
You know, it reminds me, there's a label here in town that we talk about, or I talk about a lot, called Indoor Shoes, that books all the shows and everything here in town. And the guys that run the label, when they were younger, they were up in Toronto watching the Weaker Thans play, and John stops during one of his songs and he's like, "Who here in the crowd plays guitar?" And the one guy from the label points at the other guy and he's like, "This guy does." So John turns to Eric and he's like, "Come on up on stage," and just gives him his guitar, and he's like, play a lick or something like that, right? And I think that it was just like, it wasn't even just like, come play this song, or it wasn't, you know, who knows this song. It's like, who in the middle of the show wants my guitar and a spotlight on them?
You know, one time I saw this is one of his very last shows. I saw Jay Riotard in San Francisco, and for his it was a cool show. I guess maybe people might have forgotten who Jay Riotard was, but for a little while he was like the hot indie performer. Like everyone like loved his album Blood Visions and the follow up to that, which was a singles collection. And so for his last song, like the whole show, I think the guy was probably on ecstasy or something. The whole show, this guy is just freaking out in the front of the stage. Like the whole show, he's like headbanging, throwing his arms up and down like a maniac for the whole show. And Jay Riotard was a pretty big guy. And the last song, Jay Riotard reaches down, and people think I'm making this up, but I'm not. He reaches down, he pulls the guy up on stage like Darth Vader. Like, you know, in Star Wars, when Darth Vader lifts the guy up by his neck. Anybody?
Oh yeah.
So, but like, well, Jay Riotard did it, like with like still holding his guitar, he grabs the guy by like, the shoulders, like pulls him straight up onto the band, like on the stage, like kind of like pushes him. The guy like stumbles backwards. Jay Riotard takes off his guitar, literally throws it at the kid. The kid catches it, and it's clear the kid doesn't know how to play guitar, so he just like starts smashing it with his fingers, and it makes this like wild cacophonic sound, I guess, cacophonous sounds, and Jay Riotard just starts screaming into the microphone, and it was one of the wildest endings to a show I've ever seen. It was insane.
You know, nice. If anyone is looking for a random Jay Riotard thing to go listen to, Pup, everyone's favorite band, covered My Shadow by him.
And I was just about to say that.
Yeah, it's the B-side on their Reservoir 7-inch.
Let's drop a hint. At Punk News, we're working on a super secret but very neat project. Pup is included on that project.
The project might involve nudity. it probably doesn't. So I'm going to break from whatever we were about to do here, and whatever story we were just about to get to. And I want to make amends to the listening audience here, because earlier in the show, John asked me a question, and I completely blanked on him. So I want to make up for that. So the reason I completely blanked was because we were talking about Andrew Jackson Jihad. And I had it in my head that I'm like, you know, there's a band that I really liked that sounded so much like this band. And why did I like them?
Like Andrew Jackson Jihad.
Yeah. So then I just started to ignore the podcast and went into RDO and started flipping through songs to try to figure out who it was. And at that point, you were talking about Really Red. So anyways, I want to play a song. So this is a song from a band that was from Guelph, Ontario, the city I went to university in.
Wait, does this band sound like Andrew Jackson Jihad?
Yeah, there's a similarity there, right?
I think it's a song.
No. This yes. The preamble to my song was related to the song that I'm about to introduce. Thank you. So, anyways, the band was called Royal City. Now, Royal City, they were an indie rock band out of Guelph, Ontario, in the kind of like early 2000s. I'm not entirely sure when they called it quits. Oh, sorry, 1999, 2004, they were around. They were on Three Gut Records, which, if you were an Ontario music person at the time, was a pretty big deal. Three Gut was the label that had Cuff the Duke on it. It had the Constantines on it back in the day. It was a fairly important label as far as indie stuff that was happening in Ontario. So anyways, Royal City was on that label. A prominent member of Royal City who's gone on to have quite a solo career is a guy named Jim Guthrie, who you may have heard of. And he's done all kinds of crazy things. Jim actually had a huge amount of success in the past few years for writing the score for a video game called Sword and Sorcery, which is an iPad game. Anyways, this is a Royal City song. It really reminds me of Andrew Jackson Jihad. I don't know. You guys can tell me if it reminds you of that. So this song is called Here Comes Success. It is from Royal City. So here we go.
Well, here comes success.
Here comes success.
Over my hill.
Over my hill.
Here comes success.
Here comes success.
Here comes my car.
Here comes my car.
Here comes my Chinese rug.
Here comes my Chinese rug.
Here comes success. In the last ditch.
In the
right, and we are back. That was Royal City, and Here Comes Success. There's other stuff that's on their records that gets super dark and weird, and I think that might be why they remind me. The song that I played was not super dark and weird. It's just fun. But anyways, we're going to keep talking about things on this podcast that I'm going to try not to derail too much. So we're going to go from weird Canadian indie rock to Napalm Death. So the band has released a new track. The tune is called Cesspits, and it's off their recently announced album, Apex Predator Easy Meat. The album is due out on January 26th via Century Media. And the band is also heading out on tour soon with Iron Reagan and Voivode this summer. So there's a whole, you can find this song streaming on Punk News, and there's a whole statement from the band where they talk about it here. John, Napalm Death.
Napalm Death are legends. And honestly, I don't like a whole lot of extreme metal because like vocals are important to me. If I can't understand what you're saying, or at least get an idea of what you're saying, I kind of lose interest in a band. Napalm Death is one of the extreme metal bands that I absolutely love. A lot of people don't know this. Napalm Death actually started out as like an anarcho-punk band, almost kind of like the first Discharge EP, before Discharge even did D-Beat, you know, sort of crassish. And there's actually like four Napalm Death EP demo cassettes that sound just like that. They actually didn't become like a heavy, like, well, they invented grindcore in, like, I think it was 86 with their album Scum, but they were like an anarcho-punk band before them. And as a matter of fact, their very first official appearance is on Crass's Bullshit Detector. I think it's number 2 is where Napalm Death is. A lot of people don't know that. But after that, they created grindcore, and then they stopped doing strict grindcore after about 3 albums. And they went more in a death metal-like version, and they've had a lot of ups and downs in their career. Let me tell you, for the past 6 or 7 years, Napalm Death has been on a high note. They've been putting out some of their very best albums ever. Like, their albums now generally have, you know, 2 things, either super short, fast, and brutal, like classic grindcore, or very intense but intricate and twisting, nasty music. But on top of that, is their songs aren't just about, like, you know, piles of skulls, killing bodies. Like, Napalm Death is actually an extremely political band. And if you read their lyrics, it reads like an anarcho-punk rock album, except for it's like this vicious grindcore. Napalm Death is one of the few metal bands that really has just gotten better and better and better as they've aged. I'm excited for this. This is going to be a good release.
I mean, I listened to it. It was cool. I'm not really into the grindcore thing. I love the album art though. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, well, they always have a lot of cool, like they're very into their album art actually, and they're into every. I mean, you know, I mean, really, if you really want to think about it, they're, you know, one of the classic anarcho punk bands where like everything's integrated, like, you know, the album art like folds out in the neat things, and they have like literature with the music, you know, that kind of thing. And so speaking of another long-running band, Faith No More has released a new track. The track is called Mother Effer. It's their first track since 1998. It's going to be out on Record Store Day, like we just talked about. The flip side is a remix of the same track by Scraping Fetus Off the Wheel, also known as Fetus, also known as J.G. Thirlwell. The release is out on Mike Patton, lead singer of Faith No More's own label, Ipecac Records. A lot of people are really, really, really excited for this. If you go on, actually, I mean, their song debuted at Rolling Stone. It was huge over there. Faith No More kind of, to me, is like the Smiths, and that, like, you never, ever hear them on the radio. You never hear people talk about them, except for people at, like indie concerts. But they're huge, and they sell as many tickets as, like, Bruce Springsteen, you know? So it's very hard to gauge. Are you guys into this track? Are you guys into Faith No More? Is yet another reunion. Can you guys stomach another reunion?
I did like this. This was really fun and atmospheric and cool and dumb in like a really fun kind of dumb. There was someone actually on the if you're like looking through the comments on Rolling Stone, someone compared it to like a goofball Tenacious D track, and I could almost see that because if not for the I guess deserved respect that Faith No More seems to command out of people. It is sort of a really dumb song that uses the word motherfucker over and over again. And I mean that in the most endearing way possible. So anyways, yeah, this, I don't know, this was fun. I don't have a lot of history of Faith No More, so I can't place it. I can't really tell. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you when you said that they're, you know, they're popular, but you can't peg them. That they're, and I feel that that's how they've always been with me. I mean, I came of age in the 90s, so I should have been in tune with what was going on with this band when it was coming out originally. And it was always sort of on the periphery. You know, they had their one big radio hit. And then outside of that, you know, people spoke of them in very loving but hushed tones. And aside from that, I didn't really get a lot of sense of what was going on in their world.
You know, I bet you, Adam, I bet you a lot of people listening these days don't even know their one big radio hit, the song Epic.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I feel that I have more familiarity with Mike Patton from the stuff that he was doing with Dillinger Escape Plan, because that was a really big release back when it came out. Remember, we talked about it a lot on Punk News. It was the one that Epitaph released back in 2004, 2005 or something like that. Like, that was a really big deal. A lot of people were really into that. Punk News owner Aubin was super into that when it came out. But Faith No More is one of those bands that, you know, they have their fervent fan base and they have a lot, they have longevity. I mean, yeah, you can call this a reunion, I guess, but I don't think they're a band that, I don't know, to me, they're
98.
Yeah, but there's something about being a band that has a certain amount of, where you're enigmatic enough that you don't necessarily live and die by the traditional, like, oh, we broke up because we hate each other, oh, we're back together for a reunion tour kind of time frame that, you know, that other bands do. I feel like they get more, I feel like they're getting a bit of a different pass than other bands would. Some bands get back together after that much time and it's like, oh, here's another reunion thing, like the Pixies were like that. And hey, I was excited to see the Pixies when they came back because I'd never seen them before, but it was really clear, like, hey, this is a reunion show, we're gonna go play in, you know, a big aircraft hangar in Toronto, and you're going to come see us, and we're going to play, you know, Wave of Mutilation, and you're all going to get excited. And, you know, it was a nostalgia thing. I get a feeling that, like, at least with what I've seen from fans, with the Faith No More thing, it's like, oh, weird, these guys are back, what a cash-in. It's more that, like, finally, here we go. But I don't know.
I didn't get it. I wasn't into it. Like this, in the, like the talking creepily into the microphone, singing kind of thing, just kind of turned me off. But I hadn't really heard of this band that much.
They should do a split with Turbo Negro and put like, don't say motherfucker, motherfucker on the one side, and then put this song on the other side.
I would enjoy that. Ricky, do you know the song Epic? You want it all, but you can't have it.
It sounds familiar, but I
that's again, the like, worst it sounds rendition like that. Of that.
Well, how would you do it, Adam?
I'm not going to.
Oh,
Why don't I just settle this and look for it real quick?
Yeah, do what I do. Go listen to streaming music during the podcast and ignore what's going on. It makes for a good show.
Listen, speaking of streaming music, Joyce Manor and Toys That Kill are putting out an EP, which surprised me. I mean, that's not a necessarily obvious connection. They're streaming two tracks. Choice Manor streamed the track Tame, and Toys That Kill is streaming Times We Can't Let Go. I found this interesting, A, because, I mean, Choice Manor and Toys That Kill, I didn't know there was a connection between those two bands. B, Choice Manor had a huge hype behind them, but I kind of feel it flamed out immediately, almost. I mean, is Choice Manor still a hype band, or people don't care anymore? They had that album come out this year on Epitaph, Never Hung Over Again, back in July. I mean, people were talking about their last two EPs for, like, all year long. This one came out, everyone forgot about the band right away.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what happened with that record. And I don't even think it was a bad record, per se. I mean, like, I remember, I think I've hum and hawed on this podcast a lot in the past about how, like, Joyce Manor was good because they wrote short little fun songs. And if they tried to write bigger songs, it wasn't going to work. Or if someone forced them to write, I don't know, more traditionally structured songs, it wasn't quite going to work. And I don't really feel like the new album made that mistake. It's just, like, I don't know about you, but, like, I tried to get into it, and I can't remember a damn thing from it. So, yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Go ahead.
You can come talk about Faith No More now.
Yeah, well, you know what song people are still talking about? You want it all, but you can't have it.
Go ahead.
Ricky.
Okay. Anyway, so yeah. So, yeah, I don't know what happened to that Joyce Manor record.
It is it.
Oh, you're still going?
I'm done. I'm Faith No More out.
So, anyways, yeah, but this, as far as the split goes, this is interesting because they're not two bands at all I would associate with each other. But, you know, Toys That Kill writes pretty solid little fun short punk rock songs. Joyce Manor, when I like them, write really cool short solid little punk rock songs. So, and, you know, they've got a Ramonesy kind of track that they've thrown on here. So, hey, this is fun. I like this.
Okay, so when did you say this this Faith No More song came out? I'm sorry, you're going back.
Like 88, I think.
Oh, 88? Oh, yeah. Then, yeah, I mean,
I think maybe 91. Let me look,
I would not have heard this because it didn't sound familiar. But anyway,
89.
Were you conceived to this song?
I was not. My parents had just gotten married in 89. But this EP, though.
My parents got married in like 1976.
Yeah, there's an age gap here.
So, hold on, you could have been conceived to this song.
You could have.
No, I was born in 92.
So
you could have been conceived to this song.
I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that shit.
I remember this song on the radio in 92.
Ricky, you were conceived. You didn't just like.
No, I know
you were
that.
Made of clay, and then.
This is going completely off course. You were probably conceived to a song. Most people, when they get funky, put on music in the background, unless they're in like the back of a kitchen in like a restaurant or something.
There's probably a song you were conceived to.
You should ask your parents what song it is.
I am so comfortable with this conversation.
What kind of music your dad like?
I think I got him into the Misfits, believe it or not.
But you got him into the Misfits. I mean, what did your dad listen to on the radio?
Oh, he was really into like Nick Lowe and Rockpile.
Who?
Nick Lowe.
I don't know who that is.
It was like power pop stuff from the 70s.
Oh, so you probably can see the Cheap Trick then.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, probably Surrender.
Surrender or, The Flame or whatever. But yeah, this EP. Back to the Joyce Manor Toys That Kill EP. I was cool with the Toys That Kill song, but I've never been into Joyce Manor. And going back to what you guys are talking about, the album, when I went to FYF Fest to review it and I saw them, the kids were going nuts. Everyone under 20 was freaking out that they were playing songs from that album and just that the fact that they were singing Joyce Manor. And by the way, people were crowd surfing.
Mm.
So, yeah. That's a thing.
Well, there you have it, folks. Ricky was conceived to Dream Police. Dream Police. Anyways, let's wrap this up. We had a pretty neat We'll Do It Live at Punk News. We've been doing more and more We'll Do It Lives, and I think it's cool. We'll Do It Live is a feature you at Punk News where a guy of a band gets on the website, and you can ask the band questions directly or the artist directly. We just had one with CJ Ramone tonight. Of course, you all know CJ Ramone was the last guy to join the Ramones, and he played bass for the Ramones, and he also did vocals. I think he was a Ramone from 89 to 96. I think that's the correct year. Anyway, CJ Ramone's got a brand new album coming out. The album is called, I know Mark Little reviewed it, the album is called Last Chance to Dance, and on his We'll Do It Live, he talked about being in the Ramones, he talked about his new record. Was there anything that really stuck out with you guys from his We'll Do It Live, anything that stuck out from you about the record?
I've not heard the full record yet. I've only heard the singles so far that we've shared. So I'll come back to the comment on that.
Well, I'll tell you what I thought was really interesting is I've been dying to ask A. Ramone this for years. And I actually asked Joe Sib this of Side One Dummy about 3 years ago. Actually, more like 6 years ago now, maybe 5 years ago now. I said, because Joe Sib, he recorded with the Ramones a bunch. He was like friends with the Ramones. I said, Joe Sib, the story that Johnny and Joey hated each other, never spoke to each other, I wonder if that's overstated. How could they be in a band that much you know, like for 24 years and like really hate each other that much. How can you function like that? And Joe Sib said he didn't agree with me. He affirmed my question, and he basically said that the disconnect between the Ramones is overstated and that maybe they didn't like each other, but they, you know, functioned or whatever. However, I asked CJ Ramone the same question. I said, CJ, and I found this extremely interesting. I said, CJ, while you were in the band, how were Johnny and Joey towards each other? Did they talk? Was the animosity overstated? Here's what CJ said. The animosity was not overstated. They never talked except when it was about business, and even then they talked through whomever else was around. And honestly, I tend to believe CJ on this one, which I find so – how could you hate someone that much and be in a band with them for 24 years? But even that – like how do you write a song with that person, or how do you – even go on the road with that person? Like, how do you not talk to somebody for 24 years? Like, you would have to, like, you know, pardon me, I need to walk past you or something like that.
I've got to imagine that, like, you know, if one of them was in the other one's way, they would say something, but they're not going to have casual conversations. I mean, still, how would you do that for 24 years? But yeah.
I mean, didn't the Clash hate each other by the end of it, at least? Yeah, and they were still playing shows together.
Yeah, true, but it wasn't – they did hate each other, but they used to be super good pals, you know, and because they all got, like, kind of famous. But, I mean, they were friends again. Well, actually, it's the Clash is very weird. It's that, like, the band broke up because Mick Jones got fired from the Clash by Guy Stevens and Joe Strummer. But, like, a year and a half later, Joe Strummer and Mick Jones were friends again to the point where Joe Strummer – produced Mick Jones's second Big Audio Dynamite album. But I think Mick Jones and Paul Simonon, I think they really hated each other, you know?
Yeah.
But then they toured with each other, you know, a couple years ago with Damon Albarn, but I think they still hate each other. I'm not exactly sure. But, I mean, that's a little different because they used to be super good pals and they sort of just grew apart but then kind of became friendly again. Whereas the Ramones, it's like they were never that good friends, and then Joey stole Johnny's girlfriend. No, I'm sorry. Johnny stole Joey's girlfriend, and so, like, they never spoke to each other again, you know. But also, not to get too off topic, people always say, how could Johnny do that? What an ass. And true, I mean, you shouldn't steal your friend's girlfriend or whatever. But, and this is, whose argument is this? Was this Mickey Lay's argument? No, it wasn't Mickey Lay's argument. Who was? Oh, Tommy Ramone. This is Tommy Ramone. Yeah, this was Tommy Ramone. It's in one of the Ramones documentary. He's like, it's not like Johnny stole Linda Ramone just to spite Joey. I mean, he married her and stayed married to her for the rest of his life, you know, and to Joey, she was just a girlfriend. It's not like she was the only girlfriend Joey ever had or even the only girlfriend he had at the time, you know? So it was lame for Johnny to do that, but it was, quote, true love, you know what I'm saying? So I don't know. I mean, like, if I was going out with a girl and wasn't super involved with her and one of my pals stole her, I'd be pissed off. But if they stayed together for a while, I'd probably get over it, I would think. I mean, not if it was, like, my wife or something, but if it was just a casual girlfriend, you know? I don't know.
Well, also, I think, wasn't Johnny, like, had, like, a completely different political view than everyone else in the band?
Yeah, well, Johnny was very conservative, but, I mean, I hate to paint him even as that. He was very conservative on some things, but a few things he would probably be considered very liberal on, you know, on certain other things. But, I mean, even so, you can still be friends or talk to somebody, you know? But also, I mean, it's not like Johnny was a nice – Johnny was a hard ass, too. I mean, he maybe he could have been nicer to people, you know? Yeah. I just can't believe a band that dysfunctional lasted 24 years. And only broke up, not because they, like, imploded, just because they were all, like, said, well, it's time to be over. It's not like somebody, like, said, F you guys, I quit, you know?
Well, yeah, that's funny because the that was the one thing that the one question he answered I thought was kind of interesting in that light, where someone asked if it was true if Mr. Brett from Epitaph Records and Bad Religion was pursuing the Ramones to sign to Epitaph. And he said, yeah, they were, what he said, Mr. Gerwitz was aggressively courting the Ramones, and I begged Johnny to do it, but we were close to the end of our career, and Johnny didn't like change, so we signed to our manager's label, Radioactive, instead. Like, that's interesting to me, just the realization that, like, we were close to the end of our career. Where, like, there was something in them that said, like, you know what, yeah, we're still a band, we're still doing this, but we're not going to do this for that much longer, so you know, we don't need to go sign to this big label and get this push.
I think that would have been a really interesting pairing, Epitaph and the Ramones, looking back.
I mean, that's kind of what Fat's doing right now, isn't it?
Well, on one hand, I guess they'd be like a little bit of a trophy signing, you know?
Yeah.
That's true.
Hell, if I had a label, I'd go sign the fucking Ramones, right? So, that, you know, I can't blame them. You always want to think that, like, bands are incredibly into being in their band and assume it will go on forever until it doesn't.
Well, I'm sorry.
But, yeah, so just them having that perspective, we're like, you know, no, we're close to the end of this. We're not going to go sign. I don't know. That's interesting.
Well, that's one of the things I find extremely interesting about Johnny Ramone. I think it's in Ramones at the End of the Century. He's like 1977 to 1979. That's when we were in our prime and at our best. And it's very unusual for a musician to say, this was my prime. I'm not as good now. We're still pretty good, but we're not as good as we used to be. You know, bands almost always says, well, I think my newest record is my best record. So I found that Johnny Ramone had a very unusual, objective view of his own band.
Or maybe he's just being honest.
True, but I mean, like, a lot of bands, like, you know, a lot of bands put their heart and soul into albums and stuff. And so when they're done with what they're done with, they truly feel it's their best work, even objectively, if it's not. Whereas Johnny Ramone is like, nah, our new stuff isn't as good as the old stuff. It's a very unusual position, you know.
Huh. So anyways, yeah, if anyone wants to read this, you should go to Punk News. Search for CJ Ramone. The title of the article is We Do It Live, or We'll Do It Live.
We do it live.
Well, granted, if you find an article called We Do It Live, which you won't because it doesn't exist, then it'll probably just link you to this one. But it's We'll Do It Live, CJ Ramone. So, yeah, whoever I'm talking to should go listen to that or read it with your word ears.
I asked him a few things on here, but I think the one question I asked that I really wanted to get an answer from about was, I asked him, what was it like to be interviewed for We're Outta Here after the breakup on Howard Stern? Was it tense off camera and off the air? Was it as tense off camera / off the air as it was on? And he said it was tense. I was hoping he was going to talk about, like, being on the Howard Stern show, but he didn't. He said Joey turned down a $1 million offer in Argentina, and the guys were really upset. When Joey asked me, I told him, you gave the band 22 years. If you don't want to do it, don't. I knew he'd been diagnosed for a long time at that point, but didn't know if John or Mark did. So clearly things were going downhill even then. But I also provided the link for him because they were on the E Show, and it's a really interesting video if you find the link and watch it.
Well, there you have it, CJ. I gotta say that CJ Ramone We'll Do It Live does have a lot of very interesting tidbits in it. Let's wrap up tonight's podcast, Ricky. So glad to have you on. You know,
always a pleasure.
Next time, listen to Cheap Trick. I hope you remember what happened during, you know. You know, Surrender, what happened during
I think
All Shook Up.
I think Live at Budokan is forever ruined for me.
This first track is the first one off our new album. And then there's all that applause. Adam White.
Yes, sir.
As always, bring your charm, your wit, your knowledge to the Punk News Podcast. How could we ever thank you enough or congratulate
with money?
Enough? Adam White, thanks for being on. And any closing words, Adam White? Anything else we should know? What's your go-to? You have two children. What's your go-to conceiving song? What song do you use when you're trying to conceive children?
No, I've done this twice, so I'm just trying to put my finger on it. No, I think we're more of like the no music back of the restaurant kitchen variety, to tell you the truth.
I should have asked that question. Now I know Adam White's most intimate details. But is he pulling my leg? I'll never know. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next week.